Your weekend begins in Crystal Palate's Wine Country with sommelier Crystal Cameron Shad. Every week, Crystal takes your palate on a journey from the vineyard to the glass and opens your mind to the endless choices that await your next sip. Uncork your passion starting now on your trip through Wine Country on CBL 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Crystal Cameron Shad. It is so nice to be with you today. Thanks for joining me as we swirl, sip, and savor our way through Virginia wine country. I'm so excited to welcome international winemaker Michael Schaps to the program. Now, if you're a lover of Virginia wine, chances are you're very familiar with the name. Michael Schaps arrived in the Virginia wine scene in 1995 and was a driving force behind growing the brands of Jefferson and King family. He established his own label in Virginia a decade ago and has received numerous awards and accolades over the years. Michael now spends most of his time between the vines of Virginia and his winery in Burgundy, France. He has the largest contract winemaking operation in the Commonwealth. He consults on numerous wine projects, and he's also bringing fun value wines to consumers by embracing a change in how some of his wine is packaged. Thanks so much for stopping by the studio today, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start back in the beginning. What got you into wine? You studied in Burgundy, but you are from America.
Yep.
So talk a little bit about your history and what got you into wine.
Well, actually, I stumbled upon wine after college, managing a restaurant in Boston, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my career. I studied marketing and economics in college and led me to Boston with my friends, and while I was there, I was managing a pretty high-end restaurant at the time in the mid-80s, and they put me in charge of the wine program, which was really ahead of its time. Huge Cuvenet system, almost 300 wines on the list, a big wine by the glass program, and so I had to learn quickly how to manage the wine program. So I was studying a lot, tasting a lot, and eventually led me to France. My interest in wine really peaked and wanted to learn winemaking, and was fond of Burgundies and French wines. And so I decided at age 26, I didn't have much to lose. So I did some research, packed my bags, and headed to France and ended up there for almost 2 years.
So you jumped in with both feet.
Yep.
And from Burgundy, you continued your education in Burgundy.
Yeah, I studied at the Lycée Viticole de Beaune. I was the only American in a French program at the time.
Did you speak French before you went there?
Not good enough, actually. The director of the school wouldn't agree to let me enroll because my French wasn't good enough. So I had to convince him, and we worked out a deal that I could go to the school for free, no tuition, because he didn't think I'd make it through the program. But in exchange, I would have to do conversational English with the other students twice a week after school, and I could stay in the program as long as I was passing the classes. So that was enough of a crack in the door that I kind of barreled on through and pulled more all-nighters studying over there in a little over a year than I did in 4 years of college.
And that was your payment?
Yep.
That was your payment. How's your French now?
Well, I have to deal with bankers, lawyers, and accountants when I'm there, so I guess it's good enough.
Bon. Well, très bon. Well, so you spent some in Burgundy. You actually do have you have your own product line in Burgundy as well, and you came to Virginia in 1995. Now, you're from the Northeast. What was it about Virginia in the mid-90s that kind of grabbed your attention?
Yeah, I saw it as an up-and-coming region. I had opportunities on the West Coast. I actually had an opportunity to stay in France as a winemaker. But I wanted to do something on my own and take all this knowledge and experience that I had picked up in 2 years in Burgundy and bring it back to an area that was up and coming to try to develop, be part of something that was growing. So I ended up in 1995 at Jefferson Vineyards, and there were 43 wineries in 1995 when I got here.
And my things have changed.
Yes.
Over the past 20 years.
Almost 300 wineries now.
So let's talk for a minute for the listeners that may not know. When you look at Burgundy, for example, it has some of the, if not the tightest, some of the tightest wine regulations in the world to grow and make wine within Burgundy. And then you're in America, in Virginia. We have a little bit more lax wine laws. Talk a little bit of the advantages and disadvantages of making wine in both areas.
Well, there are laws in Virginia, plenty of laws too, but there are more qualitative restrictions in Burgundy that we don't have here. That's the main difference. The yields in the vineyards are regulated, so you can only grow so much. You can't overproduce, which will jeopardize, you know, stressing the vine and the quality, eventual quality of the wine. So they're trying to protect the quality of the region. So there's a lot of governing board in France all over that regulate the industry in each region. So the restrictions on that, what products you can use and can't use, have changed over time. Actually, they are getting a little bit more open-minded in different things. So for example, in Burgundy, for many years, you couldn't use any oak additives like oak chips or beans or anything like that. Now that's changed, where here it's been perfectly legal, so you can actually add oak chips to a barrel of wine instead of buying a brand new barrel. You buy pre-toasted oak chips and put in to help give you a little more impact on the wine. So things have changed in France, but primarily they really are there in place to protect the image of the region.
And the tradition. I think if you look at the generations of tradition in France compared to here in America,
of course,
it's certainly a big thing. I think you'll probably appreciate the story. I spent some time, did a Viking River cruise through southern France last year, spent some time in Burgundy, and we were doing a tasting in one of the cellars in Beaune, and one of the Americans raised their hand and asked a question, and they're kind of like, well, why don't you rip up some of that Chardonnay and plant Sauvignon Blanc? Well, I think that you actually have a red shirt on today, and I think the guy turned like 50 shades of red going, we don't make recipe wines. This is tradition here in Burgundy.
For good and bad reasons. Yeah, yes. I mean, it's definitely tradition, and it's the certain varieties they've over centuries have learned really make unique wines in that region. But though there has been some flexibility recently in changing some of the regulations in the lesser appellations to allow more innovations. But no, and overall, it's pretty strict.
Now, when we talk about quality, the quality revolution, Virginia, the modern Virginia wine era, if you will, you've been here for about 22 years now making wine. What is your impression over the past two decades on quality and for people out there that may still kind of put their nose up at Virginia wine?
Well, the potential has always been here. It's just a matter of having qualified professional winery owners, winemakers, and grape growers, which has been improving steadily in the past 22 years. Mostly the industry was founded on hobbyists, retired doctors and lawyers who wanted to have a vineyard and start a winery, and they didn't really look for an ideal location. They just looked for wherever their second home was or where they wanted to retire. And that started the industry. Eventually in the 90s, more professionals came in, looked for ideal sites, brought in professionally trained grape growers or winemakers like myself. And that really started, I think, to change the image of Virginia wines. And believe me, there's still plenty of the hobbyists out there doing it, but there's a lot more well-qualified winery owners and winemakers and grape growers here.
So you've definitely seen, from your perspective, though, when you talk to people and you have someone that says, I don't drink, especially Virginia Red, right? That's been a big thing for over the years is, okay, well, the white's okay, but I don't want to drink Virginia Red. What is your just pour them a glass of wine, or?
Well, I've heard that plenty of times over the past 22 years, and I've got thick skin. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Sure.
And it's obviously you just have to win them over, and we do a lot of blind tastings for consumers where we will pour other wines from other regions that are the same price and let the customers guess which is the Virginia wine. And it's always the Virginia wine that's coming up near the top. And so it's really just an slow educational process. When I first was here, we couldn't sell much wine in Washington, D.C. That has changed dramatically. I've seen that change. It's the same snob kind of approach to the restaurants and retailers didn't want Virginia wine. And now they see the quality. So it's just a matter of, you know, breaking through and just persistence and determination.
And like with anything, it's certainly an education. It's an education for consumers. And I had Chris Pearman on the show not too long ago, and he was saying, you know, we've got to get out of this mass-produced wine concept here in Virginia, because if we're looking in that, you know, $20 to $35 price point, we're producing exceptional wines. Mm-hmm. But you got to look at it dollar for dollar and what you're getting.
Yeah. No, it's really we can't compete in the lower end or in the ultra-super high-end cult wine but we have a home somewhere, like Chris said, in that range. And really, you know, our economies of scale are really limiting us from what we can do because everyone's small growers here. But for the quality for what we put out at the price, the better wineries are actually, I consider, great values for the better producers.
Yeah, no doubt. We're doing some real exceptional things throughout Virginia. We're going to take a quick break, and on the other side, I want to talk a little bit about your new satellite tasting room that just opened over the summer, and also want to talk a little bit about how you're doing some creative packaging and how that's providing a great value for wine consumers. You're listening to Crystal Palate's Wine Country on CBIL 107.5 and 1260 WCHB.
Oh, I love the sounds of fall in Virginia. The leaves rustling, football games,
forks popping, glasses filling,
wine sipping.
I love wine sipping. It's like singing, only without sound.
Okay, let's hear it again.
Fall is the perfect time for Virginia wine. Visit virginiawine.org to discover your local crush.
And welcome back to the show. If you're just tuning in, we have Michael Schaps with us in studio today. And, you know, Michael, you have a few different brands, a few different brand lines, if you will. Tell us a little bit about your offerings and the differences between what you're producing out of Burgundy, what you're doing in Virginia, and your WineWorks label as well.
Well, the easiest is start in Burgundy because it's very small and very specific. It's Maison Schaps, where we make some very small quantity of high-end white and red Burgundy. So all basically Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and some Aligoté. So that's our brand, very small, and those wines are imported here to the U.S. and sold throughout the Mid-Atlantic. We also offer those wines in both our tasting rooms here in Charlottesville. So it's kind of neat. I have an importing company, and we can import my wines here to Charlottesville direct. They're also sold through our distributor, Roanoke Valley Wine Company, throughout Washington and Virginia. So that's the French operation. And here we have WineWorks, which is located on 20 South, and that's our main production site where we make the Michael Schaps wines. We make the Virginia WineWorks brand, and then we also do contract winemaking for almost 20 customers that are in and outside of Virginia around this area that bring us their grapes, and we make wine for them. But in the brands that we actually sell, the Michael Schaps obviously is the lead brand. That's from very small production, single vineyard sites mostly, that we manage throughout the state. And those are wines that we really kind of pride ourselves as our high-end wines. Then we have the WineWorks brand, which is a combination of box wine, keg wine, and then also some bottle wine. And that's our value brand. And we kind of mix and match that every year from different sources of grapes that we can get a hold of that we lease and manage, and try to making simpler, more ready-to-drink wines. And we started the box program now about 6 years ago, maybe longer, maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, because I do want to kind of take a deep dive into some of the new packaging we're seeing for wine and what it means to consumers. So I'm excited to talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. You know, so we have the box wine. Then we also start doing growlers on site. And so we actually keg wine. And I also started doing that on my lower end Burgundies as well. We're sending over kegs. So that's really a new thing that's really taking off, as people can come and fill up a growler, whether it's 1 liter or 2 liters, and really get some fresh wine that we, you know, put right in kegs unfiltered, and it's fun. It's real approachable wine. So we're doing those things besides the regular Michael Schaps brand.
So you really have the scale from the value wines all the way up to your kind of higher-end Burgundies, if you will,
running
the spectrum. When it comes to Virginia, for example, what do you really enjoy working with as far as varietals? Because I know when I looked at your portfolio, you're doing a Petit Manseng, which really doesn't do very well outside of the Jurançon area of southwest France. And I think, I don't know if you were the first, correct me, you're one of the first to do a dry-style Petit Manseng in Virginia.
Yeah, I've actually, I'm not the first. There's been a few others out there, but nothing that's really taken off. I like to think that mine's kind of led the way here recently with a lot of national, international press that we've gotten for it and a lot of awards. And that is definitely the lead white grape right now that I would say is by far our best variety here in central Virginia, for sure, as well as other parts of Virginia. It's an interesting grape variety. Really, for me, it's all the wines are, as you've heard, made in the vineyard. And this is probably one of the varieties that really holds up to our conditions and produces a really nice, balanced, high-quality grape that we can count on year in and year out.
What is it about the actual grape? I mean,
they're very small berries, very high-acid grape. And here in Virginia, we have trouble maintaining the acid levels, natural acidity in the grapes because of the heat and humidity at ripening. And this is a variety that elsewhere in the world has too much acid to pick at a normal, what we can say, a level that would produce a dry wine without too much alcohol. And so in other regions, they have to let the Petit Manseng ripen extremely high sugar levels in order to get the acids to balance out, which leads to either a very high alcohol wine or a wine with residual sugar. But here we seem to be able to grow this grape. It's still a challenge. It's not easy, but it's still a challenge to pick it at the right balance where there's just a good amount of acidity but not too much. and without having too much alcohol or residual sugar. So it seems to really work well, and it holds up to all the weather conditions we have here in Virginia.
It really is a stunning wine. I was only very familiar with the more dessert-style wines until I had experienced yours, and just the tropical notes and the acidity is just a really lovely lovely wine. And the weight, too, is very nice. It's almost got the weight of a Chardonnay.
Yep. We kind of treat it in between. To me, it's a little bit stylistically in between a Viognier and a Chardonnay, which everyone knows here. You know, we kind of do the similar winemaking we do with both. Chardonnay is pretty much whole cluster pressed and barrel fermented, where Viognier we destem and crush a little bit and soak it on the skins to get more aromatics and a little more phenolic character. And we do that. We do both with the Petit Mansang. We actually soak it on the skins and we barrel ferment it. So we're kind of has that those aromatics that we really find in a lot of more of those Viognier type varietals, and then it has some weight and, you know, volume that you might find in a Chardonnay.
Now, another fun grape that we're seeing more and more of in Virginia as 100% varietal is Tannat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I've always been a big fan of, actually, going back to the late 80s, I was buying Maduron wines, and those are Tannat-based wines, so I've always been a big fan of the Maduron wines, actually so much so I'm now importing a producer from the Maduron because I've always loved those wines. And Tannat has developed here in the past 10 years as something that's proving itself as a consistent red varietal. And it's similar in terms of what we find in Petit Mansang. It has naturally a little bit higher acidity. It holds up better to the conditions here. Very tannic, very dark, heavy wine. So it is really hard to make a soft, approachable style, except for if you blend it with other varieties, which we do both. We make a blend, and then we also make a varietal Tannat. And I think it really has a lot of potential here as well.
So if someone drinks, if you want to introduce someone to a Tannat, what would they normally be drinking right now?
Probably a big Cabernet, California-style Cabernet maybe, or maybe a heavy Rhone wine, somewhere in the cross in between there.
I think it's always good when you get people that are narrow-minded and only drink Napa Cabs or just Chardonnays or whatever it is, and to kind of slowly getting them to drink outside the box and try things kind of in that spectrum of that space.
Yeah.
So we talk about Petit Mansang and Tannat, and when we at the Virginia Wine Summit this year, I know you were there as well, and people were just going crazy about these two grapes and the Bordelais varietals we do so well. But will these ever become mainstream, or where do you think Virginia hangs its hat in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think we're pretty much in a good place. There's always new varieties. Everyone's experimenting. Everyone's trying new things. And we're still a young industry. We're still learning. We're trying to figure out what's the best variety in what part of Virginia. And, you know, we have to learn more about our soils and climates and where's the best place to grow what variety. So that's always going to be evolving. And we'll have new varieties that really take off. We're still learning. But I think you'll see the Bordeaux varieties aren't going away, whether it's Merlot, Franc, Petit Verdot, to a lesser extent Cabernet. They're still going to lead the way, as well as Viognier. And I just hope that I'd like to see the Tannats, the Petit Verdots that people are doing as varietals, and the Petit Mansangs really make a name for Virginia. We're trying to find our own identity with these varieties, which we actually are getting some attention from outside of Virginia because of these varieties. So we need to lead with those varieties that are drawing attention.
And it's about, like you said, it's all about experimenting. It's about educating and bringing more people into the fold to try these wines. You just opened a new tasting room over the summer down on Avon Extended, right by the new Wegmans, right?
Yep.
And tell us a little bit. I guess you're doing more of the value wines there, if you will.
Yeah, we ran out of space at our winery, so we needed a warehouse facility, and then we turned this building, 16,000 square foot building, into our bottling facility and warehouse. But there were two floors of office space that we had no use for. And then when we learned what was going on across the street with Wegmans and the whole development, we said, well, why not open another tasting room in town, since we are kind of out of the way a little bit in south of town.
Which is very common. And when you go to California, most of them have tasting rooms in the downtown areas.
Yes. So. And so we had the spot. We renovated in the past year. And finally, really, we were open since June, but really finished the whole facility in September. And so we kind of make it a different. We have it at the Wine Works. We feature the Michael Schaps wines and the Burgundies. At Avon Street, we're having we have 6 taps, so we're featuring different wines on tap all the time, 2 Burgundies and 4 Virginia wines. So you can get
Burgundy on tap.
Your
fellow winemakers of Burgundy rolling over a little bit on that
one? A little
one.
Bit. Yeah. But we're not doing high-end. We're doing Mâcon Village and, and Beaujolais. And so things that are really meant to be consumed early.
Right.
And they're a lot of fun. And so people can come in and get growlers or they can do flights there. And then besides that, we have six taps. And we also have what we call Michael's Picks, where I have four wines every week that we rotate. And that could be anything from the Wineworks label, some of the blends we do for Wineworks, some of the Michael Schaps wines, Burgundies, and then also some of my imports, like I mentioned, the Mandarin. So we change that up all the time. So we decided to make that kind of an eclectic outlet for different wines, but really not focus on the higher end stuff, make it more for every day for people in town who want to grab a bottle for dinner, who don't aren't looking for something they have to age and get fill up their growler. We have a lot of people coming from the neighborhood every day filling up their growlers that will last them a couple days or whatever it is.
That's
so that's a lot of
cool.
fun. And then we also have an event space upstairs that has a catering kitchen for private events, so we can do dinners. We've started to do dinners there, winemaker dinners. We do a lot of tasting, you know, private events up there for our clientele, private tastings, and so it can hold about 50 people.
Very cool, and it's right in town, so go check them out, especially if you're hanging out, going to do some shopping at Wegmans. Go get some wine at Michael Schaps, extended there on Avon. And we're going to take a quick break, but I want to delve deeper into this trend we're seeing, the alternative trends with different containers. You mentioned them a little bit with the growlers on tap and whatnot. So I want to kind of talk to you about quality on those and what the consumer needs to know coming up after the short break. Stay with us.
Oh, I love the flavors of fall in Virginia.
I know, right? Everything's all salted caramel and spiced pumpkin.
And petite verdot-y and sauvignon-y.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Yes, I am. Let's go do a tasting.
Viognier!
Fall is the perfect time for Virginia wine. Visit virginiawine.org to discover your local crush.
And welcome back to the show. Michael Schaps is with us in studio today. And for this segment, we're talking about wine containers. We've certainly come a long way from the clay vessels used by the ancient Greeks and Romans. And it seemed for a while that the 750 milliliter bottles were kind of the standard. But we're seeing a trend in alternative packaging. Now, we've seen the bag-in-the-box for a while. You really introduced the bag-in-the-box concept to Virginia. And now you just mentioned a few minutes ago you're doing the wine growlers, the refillable growlers at your location on Avon Extended. And so you're really kind of embracing this trend with alternative packaging. When it comes to a consumer standpoint, though, I know a lot of people I talk to, they're afraid of saying, oh, I'm drinking wine out of a box, you're going to think less of me, or they think it's inferior. So talk a little bit about the quality as far as the consumer's concerned.
Well, the quality that we put in, whether it's in keg or box or screw cap even for that matter, is the same quality we'd put in a bottle. It's all the same. And that's really the style of wine is what we use our Wineworks style wines, and those are meant for early consumption. They're not aged in a lot of new oak. They're not heavily extracted. They're more fruitier, fresher, ready-to-drink wines of quality, of course. We wouldn't put anything in the box or keg that we didn't think was a high-quality product. So that's, you know, this exact same quality you get in a bottle, except better value in larger formats, whether it's a 3-liter box or a 20-liter keg. Reducing packaging costs, better for the environment, so on
reduces
and so
your
forth.
Carbon footprint.
Yep.
And what about pricing? So you talk about one of the 3-liter bag in the box. What about pricing on one of those?
Yeah, and pricing is really advantageous. I mean, we sell on location our box wines, which is 4 bottles for $40. So it's $10 a bottle. Yeah, where Virginia wine, it's hard to find that equivalent $10 bottle. There are $10 bottles of Virginia wine, but not a lot and not always great quality either.
So they're obviously meant to be consumed. They don't obviously need to lay down. They don't need to age. They're everyday consumption.
Ready to drink.
Ready to drink. That's a great. Thank you. That's what I was getting at. So I really haven't had anything to drink today, but they're ready to drink.
I should have brought one.
But, you know, when it comes to that, how long will it last? So you open it up, you just want a couple of glasses. What is the shelf life once it's
opened?
Well,
for the box wines, we there's no exact time, but we actually recommend 2 months max.
Okay. For the freshness.
Yes. And we know it can go longer in some cases, but we try not to. If you can't drink a box of wine in 2 months, you probably shouldn't buy it. It's 4 bottles of wine in 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what the way we look at it. We don't have every wine's different. There's no exact date till it will go bad. And so, but we put it on the box 2 months. And we've just started actually dating the box. We know what 2 months, because we learned that it might sit on a shelf in a wine shop for 2 months before someone gets it. So now we're starting to date the boxes so we know that, you know, people will have a recommended use-by date. So if it's past that, then we know maybe it's been sitting too long on a shelf.
And you were talking about the growlers, the refillable growlers, which are kind of flying off the shelves, if you will, at the new location, which is really cool. And that's obviously coming from the tap. Who needs beer on tap when you can have wine on tap?
Exactly. Yeah. No. And those, same thing. We don't recommend buying the growler unless you could drink it within, a 3 to 6 day window of
what
when
is
you
the
open.
Growler now? The size wise on that,
we have 1 liter and 2 liter.
Okay.
So we have a jug, a 2 liter jug, and then we have a 1 liter, Grolsch top bottle. Mm-hmm. Those usually the 1 liter, again, it's a little more than a bottle. If you can't drink that in 3 or 4 days, you probably shouldn't be buying it. But we have many people who fill up several times a week. So.
No judgment, right?
They're a big family. They have a lot of
exactly.
Wine.
Exactly. Wine's healthy. It thins your blood out. It's good for the heart. Well, what about your inspiration? Obviously, you spend quite a bit of time in France. So talk about the inspiration for kind of shaking things up with the containers.
Well, yeah, I mean, you see everything over in Europe in terms of the old world. Wine is really a big part of the culture, every meal. And you go into a store in a grocery store, and there's aisles of just box wines and large format wines. And, they've been able to maintain the quality there. And obviously, it's more the lower end wines. But still, with the amount of people who have wine a part of their culture and have wine with lunch, a glass of wine with dinner, it's more economical to buy the products that way. So that's where I saw it first and brought it back here. We brought the bottling equipment for bagging from France back here. And that was really where it started when I saw the new technology that we could actually put wine in bag and really protect it and make sure it's not going bad and make sure the quality is where I want it. So that's what brought it all about. And same with the kegs really kind of had that concept that the manufacturer of our kegs, disposable kegs, is in the Netherlands. So that's where it really developed over there.
It's really fascinating, the evolution. I think we get so stuck on stereotypes of changing up a little bit. And I think it took a long time for people to get over a screw top, a Stevel enclosure, mm-hmm. without thinking that was a cheap one. And we're learning that that's actually a great preservation device as well. Trend-wise, you seem to be on the cutting edge. You're a great entrepreneur. What do you see? Do you see any other kind of packaging coming down the line in the next 5 years or so, or anything that you're interested in pursuing?
They're out there. I'm not yet. Canned wine now is the big thing.
What are your thoughts on that?
I have no negative. It's the same as box or mm-hmm. anything else. But I just for me, it's just a whole nother, type of equipment and something else to manage. I'm pretty happy right now with the box and the kegs and the growlers. I mean, not to say I will never do canned wine, but that's not something I'm looking at doing. So that's catching on. That's very popular, easy, and obviously, if you put good wine in a box, you could put a good wine in a can as well.
It's just so interesting. And I was I read a study recently that I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was somewhere between 90 and 95% of the bottles that are bought in this country are consumed. The cork is popped or the bottle's open within 24 hours. So it certainly makes sense to go in this direction for the everyday, for the drink now wines.
Yes. No, there's definitely always going to be a place for aging for the people who understand wine and how it improves and how it gets the complexities and develops in bottle over long periods of time. And I hope those people actually grow in numbers. But unfortunately, the majority of people buy and drink the same day. So these are more economical, more environment-friendly way of producing and selling wine.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to maybe going down even after the show and checking out the Beaujolais on tap down at Wineworks Extended. Michael, for our audience, just go ahead and share your web address and where they can catch you at.
You can find us at virginiawineworks.com or michaelshepswines.com, and we're located on off of Route 20 South, south of Carter's Bridge is our main facility and tasting room, or at Avon Street Extended.
Perfect, Michael. Thanks so much for taking time. I know it's always busy for you, your international winemaker.
Thank you very much for having me.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And thank you for joining me in Crystal Palette's Wine Country. For more sips, tips, and perfect pairings, head over to crystalpalette.com. And next week, we'll have a showdown between coupes versus flutes and which one you should use for your New Year's Eve toast. Cheers.